So last week I was in New York on Monday night, and there was an announcement that went out, but I guess it went out late, so I apologize to anybody who actually showed up. Not my intention to be guilty of this evening's topic, which is Genevas Das. So I want to just inform you ahead of time of the next time that I plan to be out. So that will be, Yes Hashem, 2 weeks from tonight. So I should be here next Monday night, but in two Monday nights, which will be December 5th, so then I also am planning to be in New York at that time. And then after that, I should be here pretty consistently for the next couple of months, at least according to the current plans. And if anything changes, I'll let you know. Okay, great. So tonight's topic is Genevas Das, from the Dayan's Desk, number 101. So, Genevas Das really subsumes a couple of different areas of halacha, of practice, in terms of our professional lives, our personal lives. It includes any situation where you create a false impression, where you're guilty of deception, and it also is a subset of geneva in the sense that you're not allowed to engender undeserved goodwill. And there's a sugya in the Gemara in Hulin, Daf Tzadi Gimel, Amud Beis, which continues up until Tzadi Dalin, Amud Beis, which deals with many different scenarios of creating false impressions and engendering undeserved goodwill. And then there is a complementary sugya in Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis, going on to Samach Amud Aleph. You see some of the sources in the Mishnayos, which are on the top of page 3 of the source sheet, so which are almost exclusively in the realm of Mekach u'Memker, that when one is involved in business dealings, so there's an obligation not to be deceptive in terms of business practices. This might be just a form of geneva, that you sell fruit, merchandise that is advertised as being of a particular type, a particular brand, a particular quality, and in reality, it's of a totally different quality, a totally different type. Just had a shiloh about this the other day, where there was a question about whether it was okay to promote one's brands of type of footwear that they were selling as being from a particular type of company, which is a very attractive brand, even if it wasn't true and nobody would tell the difference. So what could be so bad? So I pointed out, but that's Genevas Das, and that's pretty explicit that you're not allowed to do that. There are two different cases where you're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to do it if the merchandise that what you are claiming to be selling is worth more, and you're charging the higher price, but that's Geneva Mamish. You're actually stealing money because you're charging a premium price for quality which is not premium quality. The Mishnayos have cases where you're mixing together merchandise. You have some new fruit and old fruit, and you're selling, you're mixing them all together and pretending, because you put the new fruit on the outside, so it looks like everything is all fresh and ripe, so nobody sees what's deep down on the bottom, and you're selling it all as if it's from the new crop. But there's also a case that the Maharsha talks about, where the Gemara speaks about how you're not allowed to sell certain footwear, and you claim that the leather comes from shechted animals as opposed to animals which died on their own. And this is because if an animal dies on its own, so then either it's possible that the quality of the footwear will actually be dangerous, or alternatively, explains the Gemara, that it's just not considered to be as attractive, and you're selling it as the more attractive quality. So the Maharsha says that the reason why this case is actually described in the Gemara as a Genevas Das case as opposed to an outright Geneva case is because you could conceivably have a scenario where you're not actually robbing the person of any money. You just are actually charging the amount of money that you would charge for the inferior quality, but you're pretending that it's the superior quality. So the Genevas Das is that the person thinks that they are getting a steal, that they're getting an unbelievable bargain because you're giving them the lower quality price for the higher quality merchandise. You're actually not ripping them off, but you are engendering undeserved goodwill because they think that you're giving them such a good deal, when in fact they're getting exactly what they're paying for, which is often kind of a warning to consumers in general in the world, which is that it's often the case that you get exactly what you pay for. And when something is being sold at a bargain price, sometimes it's because they've discovered that there is a defect with this produce, or it's going stale, or it was a particularly bad quality of this specific run of the merchandise as something to bear in mind. But certainly a seller, a merchant, is not allowed to fool the purchaser in this fashion. And then, in addition to sort of these two categories, I guess, of what I might call deceiving somebody when it comes to selling merchandise, and also deceiving somebody in terms of engendering undeserved goodwill, like if the examples that the Gemara speaks about are that you are giving somebody even a gift, for example, that you have a guest in your house and you open up a wine barrel for the guest. That's one of the cases the Gemara Chulin is considered to be. I don't have too many wine barrels in my house, but it was considered to be a very big deal. Once you open up the wine barrel, the wine's going to start going bad the second that you open it up. And to open up a completely sealed wine barrel for a particular guest, you're only going to give that guest a tiny little bit of wine. So it's considered like you're giving them prime quality of your sealed wine barrel you're opening up just for them. And now you're taking a risk that the rest of it is going to go bad, and maybe you're not going to have use for it. You're not going to be able to sell it in time before it goes bad. And now this guest has this unbelievable appreciation towards you. Wow, this host considers me so chashuv that they opened up an entire wine barrel just for me. Even though it means that they may suffer a loss, what a tremendous kavod that is, but you neglected to tell your guest that this wine barrel had basically already been bought by the local merchant, and the local merchant presumably won't mind if you took out a tiny little bit off the top, but otherwise all of it has already been sold, it's already been secured in terms of the host being able to get the benefit of the value of the entire barrel. And you didn't disclose that, you didn't share that with the guest, so that's considered to be deception, not in the course of business dealings, but just in the course of creating a false impression, engendering undeserved goodwill. Or an example that the Gemara gives, if there is an impression created, for example, when you're going out and you meet somebody in the street and they happen to be traveling from a different city, and they think that you came out to escort them. So under certain circumstances, that might be considered to be that you are conveying a misleading impression. Now, there is an exception to the rule, the Gemara seems to indicate, if we can say about a specific situation that the person was mate themselves, that the person kind of, you know, fooled themselves, there was no reason for them to think that you were going out to greet them. That was kind of their own extrapolation without legitimate cause. So if it is their own extrapolation without legitimate cause, so then we say, Iuhu dekam mati nafshe, that the person is fooling themselves, and that you don't have to correct a misimpression along those lines. But otherwise, if you're affirmatively creating a misimpression, you know that somebody is not going to go to the chasana that you're making. You know, they're not going to go. And you extend an invitation to them. This is sort of a dilemma. Like, we made a chasana, and, you know, we invited a bunch of people to the chasana, but we really wanted everybody to come to our chasana. That was a good thing, you know? But let's say that you know, really don't expect, you know, the person to come, and you don't even want the person to come. And you sort of create a false impression, so that's considered to be a wrong thing. Or, if you invite somebody to your house for a Shabbos meal, and you know that they don't go to anybody's houses for Shabbos meals, but you want to make it look like you really, really want to, and you just, you're mopsir. You say over and over again, you plead with them, please come, please come, please come. You know, sometimes you might get into trouble. They might say yes, but you're like very secure that they're going to say no, and you just want them to feel like desired by you. So the Gemara says that is considered to be an isser. That's considered to be an isser of Geneva Stas. Ayisarhev Adam Lachaber Lisod Etzlo, Vyodeabo, Sheino Soe. You're not allowed to plead with your fellow to come before Shabbos meal, and you know that they're not going to come. You just want to make it look like you want them very badly. So these are all cases that are not in a Mekach or Memker context, and yet nonetheless, the Gemara says that they are also. So there is a third, a very interesting application of the halacha, which is probably different from regular, you know, business ethics. And this is something which is articulated by the Rambam. If you look in page 3, in Hilchos Mechira Perek Yefes Halacha Aleph, the Rambam says, Asul Ramos Bnei Adam Mekach Umemka Olivna Vistatam. You're not allowed to fool people when it comes to business matters. The Rambam, interestingly enough, codifies these laws of Gnevas Das in two different sections of his Yad Chazaka, which is consistent kind of with our presentation. And that is that one presentation is in Hilchos Mechira, where he talks about fairness and honesty when it comes to one's business dealings. And the other is in Hilchos Deos, where he speaks about just good character traits and how you shouldn't convey false impressions, even if it is outside of the context of a business deal. In fact, in the Sefer HaMitzvos, he says that even when one is not engaging in outright sorcery, if you just are oches es ha'enayim, you do magic tricks and you make it look like it's kind of magic, but you know, in fact, it's just that you have very clever card tricks that you know how to perform. So he says that's also a problem of Gnevas Das. I mean, that's why some of the poskim say nowadays that if you're going to do these things, it's okay if you share with everybody ahead of time, that you tell them, you know, these are really tricks and you can figure it out, and I'm going to show you how one of them works, in fact, and then I'm going to do the other one. So some say that it's, you know, better or okay if you do it in that way, although the Chokhmas Adam, that Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz used to like to quote, was very machmir about doing magic shows in general. Didn't necessarily subscribe to this hetter. But the Rambam, interestingly enough, in his Sefer Mitzvos, considers this to be a form of a Gnevas Das. So in addition to this, Rambam says something very interesting. He says, number one, you can't fool anybody. To create a misleading impression. So first of all, the Rambam says that I'm sorry? So here he seems to so the Rambam seems to indicate that even if it doesn't generate, you're just creating a misleading impression. You're creating some sort of a notion that you're good at something and you're not particularly good at it. Like, for example, the Yerushalmi says that included in Gnevas Das would be the following scenario. This is the Yerushalmi both in Maseches Makos and Maseches Shviyos. So Yerushalmi goes so far as to say, and in fact, that's why I started off saying, if you create a false impression, deception, that's sort of an independent category, even if you're not engendering undeserved goodwill. So that's the Yerushalmi's case is, you're a new Talmid Chacham in town, and you happen to know one Masechta. You know one Masechta really well, which is impressive, even to know one Masechta really well. Everybody's mechabed you, because when you give a shiur on that one Masechta, you happen to quote a number of sugyas from a different Masechta. And they don't realize that's just because when you learn one Masechta well, sometimes you have to touch upon a sugya in a different Masechta. But you don't actually know that other Masechta very well, other than, you know, whatever cross-references happen to exist. But they think, the townspeople think that you know the second Masechta really well. So they're mechabed you. They make this big dinner. This person knows not only Baba Masechta, they also know Baba Kama. So, wow, but it's pretty good just to know Baba Masechta. But really, this person doesn't know Baba Kama. He only knows Baba Masechta. So Yerushalmi says that just like there's a pasuk says, V'zed Dvar HaRoseach. These are the words of a Roseach. If a person goes into an Ir Mikla, because they committed manslaughter, and then the people want to be mechabe, that individual, they thought he just moved in because of the good climate or whatever, so he's obligated to tell them, oh, you know, I'm a rotzeach, you know, I'm here because I committed manslaughter, and if they want to honor him anyway, then they can still honor him, but he has to disclose this to them. So Yerushalmi says, the same thing is true of a Talmid Chacham who is being honored for knowing an extra masechta that he doesn't know, he's obligated to correct this misperception. So we see even if it's not necessarily going to engender undeserved goodwill. I mean, some learn the sugya that way. Some learn the sugya that way, that this is a situation where the person would have been received like a higher salary if he knows the sefer and the second sefer. But the pashtus is, no, you're just supposed to correct a misimpression about how wonderful you are. So the Rambam starts off by saying, one second, that this is also true, that the general halakha that you can't deceive anybody is true, echad ovei kachavim ve'echad yisrael, whether you're dealing with an ovei kachavim or whether you're dealing with a yisrael. Some want to say that's only in a mekach or memker context, but not if there's no business type of dealing that's going on. So maybe that's just a special rule, that if it's creating a false impression and it's not a question of a monetary transaction, so maybe that would only be true with respect to a Jewish party within the Rambam. But the truth is that the Rambam, you look in source Yud Aleph on page 4, says explicitly, when it just comes to Midos Tovos, he says, you're not allowed to engaged in smoother talk and seductive talk that's going to fool people into thinking that you're providing more than you really are. And you shouldn't be echad bepev echad belev. This is how the Acha Yosef were actually given credit for the fact that they were tocho kibaro, right? That lo yachlu dago l'shalom, that they were honest, at least, about their animosity towards Yosef, as opposed to Avshalom, who was very dishonest when it came to his interactions with Amnon, and he made it look like he was palsy-wowsy with Amnon, and then turned around and killed him. And Avshalom, son of David HaMelech, is considered to be sort of the paradigm of somebody who was a gonev das, but Tignov Avshalom is Lev Anshe Yisrael, that he fooled everybody into thinking that he was designated to be the next king, and was the head honcho. So the Rambam says that over there as well in Hilchos Deos, even in this context, he says that this applies both to Jews and to non-Jews as well. And it's true. He gives an example immediately afterwards of a sale transaction with a non-Jew. You shouldn't sell to a non-Jew basa, which is treif, on the pretense that it's a kosher, and you figure what difference does it make to the nakli, because he can eat non-kosher anyway. But then the continuation of the examples of the Rambam include not to prevail upon somebody to eat a meal with you, and you know that the person's not going to eat, and so forth. It's hard to say that the Rambam's list of examples is intended to distinguish between a Jew and a non-Jew when he starts out his sentence by saying, "Rafilu das hanachli." If he wanted to then distinguish afterwards, he should have probably been much more explicit about it. So probably the Rambam is saying that this is true across the board. And one of the reasons it's true across the board, even though sometimes we have stricter obligations in our commerce, like when it comes to charging interest, that's sort of a special dispensation that only applies to members of the Jewish community. But when it comes to midos, when it comes to just treating people with proper character traits, with honesty and fairness and evenness, so here there really is no distinction that one has this obligation owed to all of humanity. And in terms of emulating a Kodesh Baruch Hu, we know that Chosamo Shel Kodesh Baruch Hu Emes, a Kodesh Baruch Hu's seal is that of truth. But then the Rambam adds this other very, very important quality that is not necessarily taken for granted, shall we say, in the business world. I read a book once called The Deal Maker's Ten Commandments. Not exactly the same as our Ten Commandments. And The Deal Maker's Ten Commandments basically include this notion that you're supposed to make sure that you give, like the other party, enough rope that they'll be able to hang themselves. So as I said, does not appear in our Seres Adibros. In our Seres Adibros, you have Lotignov, and the Sforno understands that Lotignov really, you know, comes to include even the notion of Gnevas Das, even though Parshat Pshat, we learn Lotignov in the Seres Adibros, you're not allowed to kidnap people, he says. No, but it really, it has many shades of meaning, and it even includes Gnevas Das. So he understands that as very much a deraisa. But the Rambam adds to this, he says, Haya yodea sheyesh b'memkaro mum yodia lokeach. Not only do you not give the person enough rope to hang themselves, but you have an affirmative obligation to disclose any defect that may exist in the merchandise. This could be a defect that doesn't even change the value of the merchandise. Imagine, you know, if you're a Jewish used car salesman, it's almost like an oxymoron. That you have to be honest. You have to say, point out all the defects in the car. You can't just say, oh, look, the person will take it for a drive and they'll figure it out for themselves. And if they don't, I'll let the person take it to their mechanic. And whatever the mechanic figures out, good. And whatever they don't figure out, caveat emptor, right? You know, let the buyer beware. That's not a Jewish concept. It's not a halakha concept. The halakha concept is no. The seller has to beware not to sell any undisclosed defects to a buyer. It's kind of, but it's even, you know, more of an extension to that, because it's not a lifnei iver in the sense that you're not making a representation. You can even say, I'm selling it as is, but if you know something is wrong, you're actually supposed to point it out. So there's a story, a very, you know, cute story, I guess, in the first of the Maggid Speaks series. You know, that when it was like actually about the Maggid. And it was, I think page 66 something. It's a story about Rav Elia Cohen Dishnitzer. I mean, it's great. I recommend all the Maggid Speaks series. It's a very Pesach quote. It's amazing. So he tells a story about Rav Elia Cohen Dishnitzer, who was considered one of the Lamed Bubniks by the Chazon Ish, like a really, you know, special person, Lamed Yeshiva. And he owned an orchard, and he needed to sell the orchard in order to pay some of his bills. But it was impossible for him to sell the orchard, because he kept on, every single time a buyer came and said, I want to buy the orchard, he would just point out all the defects, all the terrible things that were wrong with the orchard. So he had one fellow who came from the United States who was looking at the orchard, and he said, well, you're from the United States, how are you going to look over his orchard? Was in Eretz Yisrael. And he said that there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Chav Tes Amud Beis, that says that you're not going to be able to take care of property, your property, if you don't have the ability to oversee the workers on the property. And if you're all the way in the United States, you're not going to be able to supervise the landscapers and those who are working on the orchard, so it's just going to go bad. So the person said, no, it's okay, I don't care about it. So he finally found a buyer who's just, everything is fine. He said, oh, but look at these trees that are in the side, and these trees are going bad, and you're going to have to, you know, deal with the fact that this part of the orchard is not as productive as other parts of the orchard. He said, no, I can live with that as well. So finally it looked, so like the friends of Rabbi Dishnitzer were happy that it looked like he finally, you know, found somebody who just was willing to buy it despite all of Rabbi Dishnitzer's protestations to the contrary. So then he saw that this person took out like some medicine, some pills that he needed to take. So Rabbi Dishnitzer said, what's going on? Why are you taking some pills? And he said, well, I have a heart condition. So he said, I'm not selling this to you. This is such a stressful orchard that, you know, it would be a big avera for me to create more stress for you when you have a heart condition. So this is a kind of the Jewish model of your honest business person, that you really have to care deeply about the seller, about the buyer, excuse me, to make sure that the buyer gets the best possible bargain in the context of selling whatever merchandise you're going to sell to them.
Did you say even if you say specify as is, you still have to disclose?
If you know that there is a particular defect that would not necessarily automatically be included within one's normal expectations of what as is means, so then you would have to spell it out. Let's put it that way. Like you happen to know a very specific problem that this has, so the pashtus is, that's what the Rambam says, that if there is a particular defect, you know, there's a particular defect, yodia lokeach, so then you're really supposed to spell it out to the lokeach, and not leave it to the lokeach to figure it out for himself or for herself. The nature of the Isur of Lo of Geneva's Das is it a Daraisa de Rabbanon, so the Ritva seems to indicate that's a source Dalin on page 2, seems to indicate that it's very much a Daraisa. As we said, the Sforno even seems to derive it from the Aseris Adivros, and the Ritva says that not only is it a Daraisa in terms of it being prohibited to fool or mislead somebody who's Jewish, but he says even this thing that the Rambam says, that it's prohibited for, and it's based on a din of Shmuel in the Gemara, prohibited to do Geneva Stas for a Nachri. So he quotes Tosos, saying that that also is derived from as an Issur Torah, from the Pasuk that says, Lo Tignovu, Lo Sichachashu, Lo Sishakaru, Ishba Amiso. So he says here, you have to be a good Baal Kriya. Because a Baal Kriya knows that the trap under the word Tignovu is an Asnachta. So even though it then goes on to say, Velo Sichachashu, Velo Sishakaru, Ishba Amiso, it sounds like a certain type of lying that is, or chicanery that's particularly prohibited when it comes to Ishba Amiso, to your fellow Jew, but that's after the Asnachta. The Asnachta is a hard stop. So Lo Tignovu, Lo Sichachashu, Velo Sishakaru, Ishba Amiso, so Ishba Amiso only goes on the latter words, but the Lo Tignovu, you can't steal in any way, shape, or form. So that includes, he says, the Geneva's Das, and that's going on everybody, not just Ishba Amiso, it's going on Jews and non-Jews. The Shari Tshuva, in source above, we already did the Sforno, which is source Hey, the Shari Tshuva says that there is another problem. And that other problem is that there's an Isser L'Shakir, there's an Isser of lying, Lo Sishakru, and we also say Bindrav Shekir Tirchak. So he says that this is a problem, the Shekir problem is really a major source of the violation of Lo Tignov, and he says that. He says, but he also doesn't say Lo Sishakru is only Ishba Miso in this context. He says, Asa Lignov Das Abiyos Afilu Das Nachri, This sin is considered to be worse even than just stealing from non-Jew, which you're also not supposed to do. But this is even worse because it has to do with midos. You're fooling somebody. Because a person lying is considered to be a terrible transgression. Because one of our major obligations in life is to be truthful and honest people. Because this is one of the spiritual foundations of what it means to be a Jew. So he says that it's an Isser Sheker. Does it matter whether it's an Isser Sheker or whether it's an Isser Geneva? So there might be certain scenarios where we might say that it's not Sheker per se, but nonetheless it's considered to be Geneva. So in the case of the wine barrel, how do you understand the case of the wine barrel? So if you go back, yes.
If he didn't say anything,
that's exactly what Rabbi Aaron Levine wants to argue. If he didn't say anything, so what would be Baruch Shekivante? That's excellent. That's excellent. So that's exactly what appears to be a potential machlokus between Rashi and Tosfos in the Gemara in Chulin. If you look in source Aleph, where we have this case of opening up the wine barrels. So we had Ula. This is about 2/3 of the way down in the large paragraph. I gave you the sugya over there. Ule ikla be Rav Yehuda pasuk lo chavios and mechuras lechenvani. And we say that what happened? Ula opened up barrels, even though they were already consigned to the local merchant. The merchant had paid for it, and it didn't it look here like he conveyed a false impression, because we just got through saying lo yiftok lo chavios. You're not allowed to open up the wine barrel that was already sold to the merchant, Ellen Kano Dio, unless you tell the person who's the guest that you already had sold it so that you won't engender undeserved goodwill. So how could Rav Yehuda have done this for Ula? So the answer, Pasuk lo chavios amechuras l'nachrai, l'chenvani. So the Gemara answer is no. The reason why Rav Yehuda was able to do it was because Oduye Ude. Because he informed. Of course, he knew the halacha. Rabbi Yehuda informed Ula. He said, I love you very much, but you should know that I already sold this barrel to the merchant, so there's no real loss for me if I'm going to open it up for you.
Yeah,
he let him know.
Isn't it Geneva because he opened it up or when he had sold it?
No, as I said, obviously that was part of the deal that, you know, he sold whatever wouldn't be used up by him. You know, that's what he sold. Not that he wasn't allowed to use a little bit, but, you know, whatever would be left over, he takes off a little bit and the rest will go to the merchant and the merchant will, and obviously the amount of wine that he had taken out will be deducted from the price. Bibayis Ema, or alternatively, the Gemara gives a second possible answer. Shiny Ula de Chaviv Le, the Rav Yehuda de Balav Hachinami Pesuchay Miftach Le. Ula was different because Rabbi Yehuda really loved the Ula, and Rabbi Yehuda would have opened up the wine barrel for Ula irregardless of whether it had been sold to the local merchant or not, and that's the reason why it's okay. So how does Rashi understand the case? So Rashi says, hold on, I don't have the Rashi over here, but Tosfos quotes the Rashi. So if you look at the Tosfos, which is source Gimel over here, so he says that, the Chain, second line over here, Rashi explains, just like you can't sell the, you can't sell an animal to a non-Jew that was trafe and pretend that it was kosher, so Rashi says, you specifically told the non-Jew that it was kosher meat, and that's why it's aser. V'cheina poseach chavios ha-mechuvas l'chenvani, k'she'omalo b'shvachani poskan devade gonev daito. And so too in the case of opening up the barrels, when is it aser? That's when the person opens up his mouth and says, I am opening it up in your honor, where you are deliberately misleading the person. So Tosus disagrees. Tosus says, even if you didn't open up your mouth, if it would be reasonable for the person to infer that you were opening it up for their benefit, even if you didn't say anything, you didn't make a special effort to mislead them, because it says that it's going to be also unless you inform them otherwise. That makes it sound that even if you didn't say anything, it normally would be usher. And also, we wouldn't have a kasha in the first place from the fact that Rav Yehuda opened up the wine barrel for Ulu. He said, oh, how can he have done that? And we gave an answer. No, he explained to him what he was doing. Well, obviously, he would not have opened up his mouth to Ula and say, oh, I'm opening it up just for you. Because clearly, Rav Yehuda was of an ilk that he wouldn't commit an outright fraud with respect to Ula. Lekach nira, therefore, Tosfos concludes, so he says that even if you didn't open up your mouth, it would still be usher because it is unreasonable to assume that a visitor, a guest, would come to the conclusion that the barrel had already been sold to a local merchant, and therefore it's a reasonable inference for the guest to think that you're opening it up for his or her benefit, and that's why you have to point out otherwise, even if you didn't say anything explicitly. So Rabbi Aaron Levine, who is of course a great economist, I think I quoted him at the end of last year as well, I took a course, he taught a course at Yeshiva College that was called Comparative Economic Systems. So it looked really good, like, you know, on the transcript. It was really all about economics and halacha. So it was wonderful. It was just like this pure halacha course that was just brilliant and fantastic. And, you know, he wrote a lot of books on the subject, but that was the name of the course from what I recall. So Mr. Rabbi Levine says that this could depend on the Nakuda, as Larry said, that if the problem is one of sheker, that's only if you actually are creating that misimpression. You say that you're doing something for a particular purpose, but it's not entirely true. But if the problem is geneva, it's nothing to do with what you're saying. It's just objectively geneva, that you're taking away goodwill from this person that you don't deserve because this guest, it comes to a perfectly reasonable deduction that you must be opening up the barrel for their benefit, and therefore you have to proactively correct that assessment. But the Gemara tells us that there are cases where you don't have to proactively correct the assessment. Like one is where it's a very interesting thing. Let's say that you have meat that is treif in the marketplace. So the Gemara says that you can be machris, people should know that some of the meat is going to be trafe. So if you sell to the non-Jews, people will know not to buy from the non-Jews because, you know, they're going to be buying trafe meat. And you say, Anapo bisrael de bnei chelo. You make a big announcement and you say that some of this basar has to go to the soldiers. The bnei chelo are the soldiers. Some of the basar is meant for the soldiers. So the question is, if you say that some of these the meat or this particular meat that I am selling is intended for the soldiers, so ask the Gemara. If you go back to the first page, the second line of the short paragraph of the second paragraph, isn't that, aren't you then also misleading the non-Jews? Like the Jews will know, oh, okay, this is for the soldiers, so it's probably not kosher. But the non-Jews will say, oh, so now we have extra meat, extra shechted meat, which is considered to be like premium glatt kosher meat. You know, you say, oh, wow, you know, the Jewish butchers are selling meat to us. We better grab it because we know that they have high quality meat. Aren't you deceiving them? Aren't you fooling them? So the Gemara answers, no. They're fooling themselves. When they're fooling themselves, you didn't say that the meat is trefasa. You said nafal bissa lebnei chayla. Why didn't you say nafal trefasa lebnei chayla? So the Gemara asks, why couldn't you just say, oh, the meat that we're selling is treif, and that's why we're making it available to the soldiers of the non-Jewish community. Why is it okay to just say nafal bisra livnei chayla? So here Rabbi Levine makes a very interesting observation. He says, because then it's almost like you're putrefying the meat. Say nafal trefasa, you're not under any obligation to make your merchandise seem much worse than it actually is. It certainly is edible. It certainly is perfectly acceptable. It's digestible. It'll be enjoyable. It's permissible. It's the non-Jews and so forth. You don't need to say, oh, the stinking, rotten, foul, you know, meat is now available, you know, for anybody who wants it. Nobody's going to buy it under those circumstances. So you can use a euphemism. It's not kosher, but, you know, napa bisul, it's still basar. And they would understand that because you say libnei chayla, that it's for this population that's not the Jewish population, that it should mean that it's not kosher. So you're allowed to use some sort of a euphemistic term as long as it's not misleading, as long as you don't say, oh, the napo shchitasa lebnei chayla, that I have, you know, kosher shechted meat that's available for the people in the army. So that you couldn't say because that would be a lie.
The only difference is if you knew it wasn't kosher meat, the market in effect is smaller, and they can over the front. So otherwise, what's the difference? If you use a Kevin's kosher...
If you're going to say trefasa, so then it's not going to nobody's going to want to buy it. I'll give you the following. But look, Rabbi Levine says you have a control market over here, and if they would come to the conclusion that they really were misled, that this isn't clear enough language to just say nafal bisra, they'll say, oh, we really thought it was shechted meat. So because of the fact that it's a small market, so you'll get feedback. You'll get the constructive feedback, and since you're only dealing with a small market that you're dealing with on a regular basis, you'll make sure that you'll be able to correct it in the future. The other advantage, says Rabbi Levine, is that it wasn't the merchants that were coming up with this advertising promotion of Nafal Bissel of Nechela. It was the rabbanim, it was the rabbis that figured out that this was acceptable. So you had like a few different protections built into the market to make sure that there wouldn't be misleading tactics. What would be sort of like a similar thing that would happen in the marketplace? You're a merchant of a store, you're a store owner, and there's a particular item that's just not selling well. It's not selling well, and you decide that because it's unwanted merchandise, you're going to mark it down, and you're going to try to get people to buy it. So when you get people to buy it, so do you have an obligation to say, oh, I'm making, this is an unwanted merchandise sale? If you say it's an unwanted merchandise sale, nobody's going to come and buy it, even though it's perfectly usable merchandise, but you're under no obligation to doom yourself in that particular fashion. You could, on the other hand, say it's a bargain sale, but if you say it's a bargain sale, then it sounds like, well, really, this is very, very good merchandise, and the higher price really is the true price, and if you're lowering it, you know, because you're giving people a tremendous bargain, maybe in order to draw them in for the future, so everyone, you know, will be misled, potentially, into thinking, oh, this is like Buster Schutze, this is like, you know, really good stuff. So therefore, sort of the equivalent would be, in this particular scenario, that instead of saying...
You could say overstock.
Right, you say clearance sale. Yeah. Exactly, that's what I was going to say. Very good. You say something like it's a clearance sale. Everything, you know, has to go. And you can use that type of language because you're not creating a misleading impression, but you also don't have to make yourself incapable of selling the merchandise for what it really is worth under the circumstances. So that's sort of an in-between case. Then the Gemara gives the case of the meeting where you meet somebody on the street, and this is a very common scenario. It's a common scenario where a person sometimes just jumps to a conclusion that they're not really necessarily justified to come to. Like, for example, I went to a dinner once for a yeshiva because probably somebody said, oh, how come you never go to this yeshiva dinner? It would mean so much to us. Maybe one of the people who calls up, you know, the fundraiser said, please come. And I went. And I didn't know who's being honored because I wasn't paying attention. And then it turns out that one of the honorees was, you know, somebody I knew. He said, oh, thank you so much. It means so much that you came out to honor me. Okay, but I didn't really, you know, come out specifically, you know, to honor this individual. So do I have, under those types of circumstances, do I have an affirmative obligation? I didn't come because of you, you know. But that could potentially make them feel bad. So are you really correcting undeserved goodwill? You're just unnecessarily making a person feel bad. So that's kind of this sugya here about Mazutra.
So what's the answer to that? You're probably better off.
We have to look at the sugya. That's the sugya of Mazutra, who is walking from Sichwa to Bei Mechuza, and he met up with Rav and Rav Sapra, who are on their way to Sichwa. So he's on the way to Bei Mechuza. They live in Bei Mechuza. They're on their way to Sichwa. Pagu Adadi, they meet each other. You had your hand up. I'm sorry.
Well, isn't it the case that for a custom color, you're actually outreach to the lineup? So it doesn't seem to be... Maybe that's an exception because it's a custom kala, but it does seem to be that people's feelings and self-esteem and whatnot is an important factor in this.
Yes, and there are a couple of answers to that, okay? There are at least three different answers, you know, to the chasen and kala case. What is that? You know, sometimes you could do an aveira lishma. You know, sometimes Gnevis Das, certainly it would be permissible for pikuach nefesh. You could think of certain circumstances. We have a major Gnevis Das in this week's parasha, right? You know, and the Nitziv with respect to Yaakov and the Vachos, and the Nitziv talks about that as an aveira lishma. Not that we would normally consider that to be mutter, to say that you're pretend to be somebody that whom you're not really, but it's an aveira, you know, in terms of how we would define these types of things. But it was lishma for a lofty purpose, so it would be permissible under those circumstances. Another explanation is, it's not a lie because a beauty is subjective, and every single, you know, kala is attractive. She's, you know, a bas malachim in the sense that she's part of Klal Yisrael. She does have her virtues, and she's attracted to a chassan, and you're accentuating those milos that she has with respect to her chassan. And the third explanation is, this is codified. Everybody knows what the deal is. Everyone knows that the deal is that you say that, you know, the kala is beautiful. And people are beginning to ruin it. You know, nowadays you have people say, ah, your kala is beautiful even according to Beis Shammai. You know, so you're going to get yourself into trouble because people will find out that you're saying that. You go to a wedding and you don't say even according to Beis Shammai, so you're kind of defeating the purpose. But here, this is actually codified, so everyone understands that this is part of the ritual, that when you're saying this, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person is going to be recruited to, you know, be the next, you know, $1 million, you know, movie starlet. But it means that this is the appropriate thing to say, and, you know, in this context, it's a correct thing to say.
The fact that it's codified, is that justification for all modern marketing?
It's an interesting question. If it would be codified by halakha, yes, but halakha would never codify to allow for, you know, stealing and cheating and misleading, because that would be, you know, against our sensibilities. It's the famous, you know, Chavos Yair, who said, what if you had all the merchants of a city who would come, who would get together, and they would say that we're going to allow unfair and ruinous, you know, business competition, where everybody is going to poach each other's customers and do what's absolutely prohibited according to halakha, but in our business environment, we're going to permit it. So the Chavos Yair said, you can't make a condition like that. It's null and void, because then you're creating a business environment that's going to create a society that's like Sodom, where everybody's going to act in a corrupt fashion because they say, okay, so we're going to allow corruption. So we're not going to codify the right to be misleading across the board. There are certain exceptional cases where, as I said, that there are justifications to consider it not to be, you know, misleading. Like, you know, just in the same way, a person buys a mekach, so they already bought it and they can't return it, so you can be mashpiach the mekach. Obviously, they liked it when they bought it, so you could say nice things. You know, we have people over my home, so I bring them to our to our living room area where I have this giant painting that I bought that I think is really beautiful, you know, and I want them to tell me how beautiful it is, because my children don't always agree with me. So, you know, they're supposed to say, oh, yeah, that's a great, right? That's amazing. That's going to sell someday for $1 million or something. You know, that's whatever. I mean, I still think it's a nice painting. But anyway, so the Gemara tells this story. So Mazut Rebbeit Rav Nachman is walking Mesichah the Beit Mechuzah. For Rabbi Rav Sapa Habakar Asu Mesichah Pagu Adadi. They met each other. Who saw the lappy with the kasu? So he thought that they went to greet him. Amalu Lamalu Rabbanan Taruah Asu Kuli Hai. Oh, come on, guys! You shouldn't have. You should have come out just for me. Oh, I can't believe you did this. So Rav Sapa, no, we didn't come out just for you. We shouldn't have, and we didn't. I don't know. I mean, the kasi mar. We had no idea that you were going to come. But Rav Sapa did add, and this is kind of like an interesting thing. He said, "Ihava yadina and tfehava tachinan." Had we known, then we would have come out more. Now, this is sort of similar. Then we would have come out, you know, we would have put ourselves out even more. We would have driven a fancy car to pick you up, you know, whatever it is. Now, this is similar to the second answer that was given as to how it is that Rav Yehuda was able to open up the wine barrels for Ula, because the Gemara said they're shiny Ula dechavi. The first answer was that Rav Yehuda informed Ula. But the second answer was that Rav Yehuda really, really loved Ula. He would have done it anyway. But interestingly, that second answer is not found in the Poskim. The Rambam and the Tur, they leave out that second answer. And the Lecha Mishnah says, because they don't Poskim like that second answer. They don't Poskim like that second answer. The Lev Aryeh is not in the materials right here, but the Lev Aryeh was Aryeh Yehuda HaLevi of Brody from the 19th century, and he says that the reason we don't follow that general principle to say, oh, well, I don't have to, you know, say that the wine barrel was already bought by the merchant, since I would have opened it for this person anyways, because we don't trust your subjective assessment that you would have done it anyway. Says that, yeah, people always have in mind that they'll do nice things if it's not going to hurt them. He says, the din said, lo shayach mistah b'nei adam. Shemidas b'nei adam, he should believe on misavet, hava ligmol chesed liyob, over reo. A person really says they will have the desire, they want to be a baal chesed. But when push comes to shove, and the money is on the line, they can't really necessarily count on the fact they're going to be a baal chesed. Bo'shena magia hefse la'atzmo. Then they think that even if they would have done it anyway. But he says that it's not entirely true. So therefore, you can't rely necessarily upon that thinking. So the idea, I would have done it anyway, only goes so far. But Rava was very unhappy with Rav Sapra that he sort of let out the beans that they weren't going there anyway. So Amle Rava, my time, Amis Lehachi, Dachlishte Ledaite. Why did you tell the Marzutra that we weren't going out to meet him? Now you made him feel bad. It's like the case, you know, of the wedding. You made him feel bad. So Safra said, but otherwise we're going to be misleading him. That's why I had to set him straight. So Rava says, no. You don't have to set him straight when it was an unreasonable inference. I mean, people walk on the street all the time. There was no reason for Marzutra to assume, because we were walking on the street, that we were going to greet him just because he was coming from a different direction. If the person didn't have a good reason to make that inference, so you don't need to correct it. I mean, my own pshat is like this. One of the reasons you don't need to correct them is because they're going to go home. If they're a reasonably intelligent person, at some point it will probably occur to them that maybe you didn't go out to greet them anyway. So they can figure out for themselves, why do you have to put it in their face? You don't have to put it in their face, because it'll come to them anyway.
But in your case, it was reasonable. What? You don't normally go, he's being honored, there you are.
So I don't know about that. I would say that with respect to the shul dinner, you can make the following arguments. In the shul dinner case, I think you could say, number one, if I did go to the shul dinner, so on some level, I was there to honor him. I'm there to basically honor the shul, the yeshiva in this particular case. So I'm honoring everything that the yeshiva is doing, including all the people who are being honored by the yeshiva. That's part and parcel of going to the dinner, that it's understood that you're going to share in the festivities part of the festivities is that you are honoring that individual. Now that's number one. Number two, it's kind of also unreasonable, I think, for the person to draw the inference, because there's all kinds of reasons a person go to yeshiva dinner. Maybe they went to the yeshiva, maybe they were urged by one of the yeshiva fundraisers that they should go there. This is a normal reason for a person to be a yeshiva anyway, so therefore I think this would be more sort of in the Mazutra camp. And I would throw in a third consideration, which is that there would be no real great, you know, appreciation when the person says, oh, thank you for coming to honor me. You know, you meet somebody in any social function, it's always kind of difficult to figure out the right thing to say. This is the standard tagline when the person meets anybody that evening, because they're being honored. So that's what they say. Thank you so much for coming to honor me. It's just sort of etiquette. It's just like the natural, normal thing for them to say, even as a way of maybe even reminding you that they're being honored, because, you know, this way they say it. So it's kind of puts the idea in their head. It's not that they're necessarily conveying that they think that you necessarily came just to honor them. It's because they are in fact being honored, and therefore this is sort of like a normal, natural thing to say. And there's no reason for you to give them like a slap in the face or pour water over their head and to say, oh no, I'm sorry that, you know, I don't really feel like honoring you, but I happen to be here anyway. So I think that in that context, it's a sort of, not only does it meet the Marzutra test, but I think it meets other tests as well. I mean, the question is, what was Rav Safra doing? Rav Safra was making the person feel this. There's a sefer on Geneva's Das, which is called Nips Fasayim. It's a really good sefer. It's written by Rabbi Yanbuv. And he writes in the Sefer that you have to look at a different story with Rav Safra. Remember, Rav Safra is the person who's described, I think, at the end of Maseches Makos as the paradigm of a Dover Emes Bovovo. He had in mind to sell something at a particular price, so, you know, he wouldn't go against what his original thought process was. He was like the epitome of an Ish Emes. That's kind of like who Rav Safra was. So Rav Safra, according to a separate medrash, which is in Maseches Derech Eretz, that says that he met somebody, and this person made the mistake of thinking that Rav Safra had gone out to greet him and gave this really, really gushy thank you to Rav Safra and so forth. And then Rav Safra, you know, basically shattered, you know, his illusions and told him, no, it's not really true. And his Talmidim at the time said, you made this person feel so terrible that they had been like, they had been riding on cloud nine. And you basically, you know, caused them to, you know, fall from such a high place. Through your response. So why did you do that? And Rav Safra explained, in part, because I'm Rav Safra, meaning that that because he was on such a high pedestal of absolute and uncompromising truth, if he wouldn't have said anything, so then it would definitely give much more of an impression that there was a truth to what the person was saying, even if the person had no right to make the inference in the first place. So it could be, suggests the author of Nims Fasayim, that's what was going on with Rav Safra over here. And Rav Safra certainly was on a madrega that he could have also added the second part, which is, had I known you were coming, I would have done more, and that would have been okay, you know, in the case of Rav Safra. So Rav Asher Weiss, one second, I'll just finish this train of thought. Rav Asher Weiss talks about a situation when you go to a wedding, and you're going to the wedding because of one side, and the other side thinks that you came to the wedding because of them. And they're extremely, you know, thankful to you that you came to the wedding. And I mean, I don't really get the case that much, because presumably each side knows like who they invited. But that's, you know, his scenario. And he says, do you have to, you know, correct the misimpression that the person, you know, thought that you were coming out specifically for them? So Rav Asher Weiss says, you don't have to correct the misimpression for three different reasons. One reason is that he says that really he thinks fundamentally, I have difficulty with this based on the sugyas, but he thinks that fundamentally the din is like Rashi, that it's only a problem of Geneva's Das if you are the one who affirmatively creates the misimpression. And even Tosfos, who disagrees with Rashi, says you don't have to say anything like, oh, I'm opening up this wine barrel just for you. But even according to Tosfos, it's only a problem when that sort of, you understand that that's the connotation. That's the connotation that you're looking to convey, even though you didn't actually say anything. So in a case where, yeah, again, I don't understand the whole story of Mazutra and the back and forth between Rav and Rav Safra, according to this interpretation of Rav Asher Weiss, but he says, so he doesn't think that there's a real issue in the first place. Secondly, he says, even if you're going to understand that there would be a prohibition, let's say of Geneva. Geneva Stas is opposed to, you know, the Sheker aspect of Geneva Stas, but the Geneva aspect of Geneva Stas, even if there would be a prohibition when it's not your intention to deceive somebody, but they just become deceived on their own. But he says that the person in this case from the other side who thought that they came for them clearly was just deceiving themselves, because everybody knows at a wedding that you might be coming, you know, for the other side just as much as you be coming for yourself.
So I
remember that it was somebody who came to Our Chasana, and I was so excited that they came all the way to Our Chasana. It's not anybody in the room right now. And I mentioned to a relative of theirs, oh, I'm so happy that they came to the Chasana. And the person said, well, yeah, because, like, it's obvious, not only are they close to you, but, you know, they're really close to the other side, too. And, you know, so I found that kind of interesting. I mean, it's okay, it didn't bother me, but, you know, but I had genuinely thought that they'd only come for us.
So yeah. If the person would have, if you don't intend to deceive, so would that go back to your idea about the magician? The magician is doing his shtick. However people interpret it is the way they interpret it. As you said, it might be Geneva.
No, the magician, the whole curse of being a magician is that you want to, like, fool people into thinking that you're doing something which is sort of supernatural.
So is it possible for a from person to be a magician, a professional magician?
That's a totally different topic and subject. So as I said, there are the post-Gim who say, even Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about it, that, you know, none of it is really, you know, magic, you know, right, per se, you know, nowadays. But the Rabbos can say that even if you're choshish for that shita, if you tell the people ahead of time, oh, I'm just doing these fancy tricks that look like I'm doing something, you know, magical, but in reality, there's a natural explanation for all them. And here, let me explain to you, you know, one of the tricks right now, so you can see.
Would you have to do that if you're entertaining?
I'm not posturing on this one way or another. Rabbi Schwartz, as I said, was a big machmer on that, but many posts can make on it.
Who do you and I know who doesn't know that it's natural?
Well, you might have.
Person,
you know,
is there one person of 1,000 who doesn't know that?
If you're doing it for a little,
you know what? You'd be very surprised. You'd be very surprised. I was once a scholar in residence in a particular program, and they had like a hypnotist, you know, one evening, and I didn't go, of course, you know, but then the next morning I hear like these older ladies, aren't old ladies, like they're probably like my age now, and they were talking about this hypnotist, and they're saying, "Wow, I can't believe it. This person actually reads minds. This person actually, like, they're able to know things just by, like, looking at somebody," or, you know, and I was not a hypnotist, I was like a fortune teller. And they were able to, like, know all of these things, you know, about this, about these people and about their personal and private lives. And I'm thinking to myself, like, who doesn't know, like, when you're just an adult, that there's, like, a trick to this, and they ask questions and they gather up information about the people before, and there's, like, a methodology to it. But they really, no, they genuinely believe it. They genuinely believe it.
I'm going to turn this telephone into a rabbit. Uh-huh. I think everybody in this room knows it's a trick.
In this room, there's a certain high level of expectation I have to those who attend my chabura. But I'm just saying that it's not, you know, something that you could take for granted in terms of the hamona. I've seen that people really don't necessarily know. Yeah.
So I have one global question and one on a minor detail. The minor detail is about the trade meet. I thought it's usher to do business in trade meet to begin with.
Yes, it's a very good question. But if it's nizdamein, then it's permissible. Like, let's say that you're shechting animals and you intend to create kosher meat, but one of them, you just make an error, or you discover after you shechted the animal that there are adhesions in the animal's lungs. So then, since it was nizdamein, you didn't do it on purpose, it just happened to come, you know, to come to you this way, so then you would be allowed to sell under those circumstances.
Okay, so the more global question is, if you're just going to das and you're not going to have any mamon, how does the Besdin get involved? Is there any penalty for doing this if you do it anyway?
It's an excellent question. So the Taz actually says something interesting, but also not in the materials, I apologize, but I do have supplementary materials of my own, my teacher's packet here. So in the teacher's packet, the Taz in Simen Shin Lamed Beis, we only have about a minute, says, Umaisim B'chol Yom, this is Simen Shin Lamed Beis L'chol Shemesh, but it happens all the time, She'adam Mokeh L'chaveh L'chaveh, So'omok L'chak Nosnul Yisak Zeh, L'Ratzisi L'mkor B'zeh Asak, he says that there were so many people who offered me this amount of money, but I didn't want to sell it, but I'll sell it to you for this amount of money. And then the purchaser buys it. V'achakik nispar shel yeshim kohen b'sakis shizoku. And then it turns out there was nobody. He made the whole thing up. There was nobody who was willing to buy it at that price, right? He says it's ma'isim b'choyom. We're not going to nullify the sale on that basis. We're only going to nullify the sale if the purchaser indicated I'm only buying this on the basis of the assumption that what you're telling me is true. That there were people who offered this price to you. But if the person doesn't say that, and there's no objective or not, it would be objective or not, that would be a problem. There's no objective or not, it's being sold, you know, at a correct price. So then we wouldn't, according to the Taz, we wouldn't, from a Choshen Mishpat perspective, we wouldn't, you know, nullify the sale. But if, in fact, it would be that there was the wrong price, we would nullify the sale. So it's a Gedevus, you know, Taz issue. The third explanation that Rav Osher Weiss says is that we do have a principle, the Gemara says, that you are allowed, like we said, we can't like plead with somebody to come to your house for a meal. But you can ask them once, even if you know they'll say no. If you're asking like other people in the room, because it's considered to be insulting, you're asking other people and you don't ask this person. So therefore he says that when you have like a kavod consideration, like especially if there are other people around, we call chaver ear, there are other people around, so then it's not appropriate to, you know, make somebody, you know, feel bad. Then it's okay if other people think that you came just for that individual, and you shouldn't dispel that notion if it's going to make the person, you know, look bad in the eyes of others. So there is, you know, that consideration as well that you would have to apply in the appropriate cases. But it's important, you know, just to underscore the impeccable honesty that halakha requires of us, so both in our business dealings and in our interpersonal dealings as well.
American secular.